This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is the Reverend Brittany Kane Connolly, the lead organizer of the Congregate Charlottesville group. CongregateCville.com is the website. And the Twitter handle is also Congregateville, V-I-L-L-E. Reverend Brittany Kane Connolly, correct me if I'm saying any of that wrong, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you for having me. Glad to be with you all today.
And thanks for joining us. So tell us what's up. What's going on? What are you planning for this weekend?
Sure. Well, we're mostly planning right now to, you know, try to keep our community safe. We are already in essentially a militarized police state with the governor having a state of emergency on Wednesday. So we are already kind of on lockdown in many ways. We also know that there are not any planned or permitted alt-right rallies, but we do still expect alt-right white supremacists to be in town. So we are working to prepare to support and keep our community safe. We are also preparing a service for tomorrow. It's called a service of repair, in which we will be led by six really talented women of color who will create an experience that will allow us to mourn, that will allow us to kind of behold the heaviness of what we've been experiencing, but will also allow us to celebrate the resistance that we've had here in Charlottesville. And we're also hoping that it can be a time where those of us, like myself, who need to continue to confront our own complicity in white supremacy, where we can continue to do that as well. So we're looking forward to that service. And other than that, we have trained and prepared and equipped people to show up for something we're calling Faithful Presence. So we've trained over 100 people in Charlottesville this past year to really show up embodied in their faith, to be alongside the most marginalized folks in our community.
The bio I have for you says you are rooted in the subversive way of Jesus. Can you explain?
Sure. I am confident in my theological understanding that Jesus was a radical revolutionary for love. Jesus, in his ministry, in his life, and in his death and resurrection, really subverted systems of violence. He subverted the status quo. He subverted all of the systems of power and resources and influence. And he did that in a nonviolent yet non-passive way. And in all of my ministry and my life, I try to embody that narrative and that theology.
There's a story that Peter Funk, as I'm recalling, well, in any case, that and Elaine Pagels has talked about this at some length, where Jesus said, you know, if a man asks you to walk with him a mile, walk with him two. If he asks you for your cloak, give him your coat as well, or your coat, give him your cloak as well. If he slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other cheek, or if he slaps you on the left cheek, turn the other cheek. And that in this analysis that they put forward, it's that the Romans had laws at the time that prevented an uprising by the Jews that were their slaves, essentially, or their property. To prevent that uprising, they were called non-exploitation laws, that you could just grab somebody walking down the street who was not a Roman citizen and require them to carry something for you up to 1 mile. But after that, that was considered exploitation, and you could lose your Roman citizenship if you forced somebody to carry something more than a mile. That the left hand was considered unclean. They didn't have toilet paper. And so if you slapped somebody with your right hand, that was fine, but if you slapped them with your left hand, then you could lose your citizenship. That public nakedness, causing somebody to be naked in public, was a crime. Typically, people had two articles of clothing, kind of a toga and then an outer coat that they also slept in. And so you could require somebody to give, you know, take off their coat and give it to you. But if you asked for their cloak as well, or mixing up my language, you would force nakedness and you would, again, lose your Roman citizenship. That these three acts were wildly subversive, designed to totally upset the Roman order. Is that argument broadly made in the Christian church, or is that something that's more on the I don't want to say the word fringe, but you know, in the realm of biblical scholars?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for bringing that up. Those are some of my favorite verses to kind of dissect and teach about, because it is not widely known in the Christian tradition and in the mainline Christian church. As I kind of have the opportunity to go around and preach about nonviolent direct action and the subversiveness of Jesus, these are often texts that I utilize, because so often they're used to tell people to be passive.
Right, turn the other cheek.
Yeah, turn the other cheek. Just let yourself continue to be abused. But that's not really what Jesus was about. You're completely correct in naming that these things that he is instructing folks who were on the margins of Roman society, were nonviolent ways to be subversive, to change the narrative, to flip the tables, if you will. And he did that throughout his ministry. And when he was essentially executed by the Roman regime, that was another way that he's turning the table. He's flipping the script. And I think we too often forget about that. We like to view Jesus as somebody who was just a really nice guy, loving everyone. And we forget that there was this subversive nature, that he was really undoing a lot of the power structures of his day.
Well, might it be that the power structures that have adopted Christianity ever since the Second Council of Constantinople really don't want these stories told? They would much rather people thought that turn the other cheek means, well, if somebody hits you, you know, once in the face, let them hit you twice in the face, rather than turn the other cheek so the person is forced to hit you with their left hand and thus might lose their citizenship. And to this day, look at how Christianity was used against slaves, for example. You know, just keep picking that cotton. Someday you'll be in heaven with Jesus.
Yeah, absolutely. The ways that structures of power kind of squash movements is they absorb them.
Yeah.
And that is the way that structures of power have squashed kind of radical movements of Christianity. They have absorbed Christianity into themselves. We see that a lot right now in our country, as American nationalism and Christianity sometimes are the exact same thing. And a lot of what we're doing here in Charlottesville, and I hope folks are starting to do around the country, is to really say that American nationalism is not the way of Jesus.
Yeah, yeah. At least as nationalism has been reinvented by the religious white right to have a white identity piece to it and a Christian identity piece to it. Pretty strange stuff. We're talking with Reverend Brittany Kane Connolly, lead organizer with Congregate Charlottesville. CongregateCville.com is the website. The Twitter handle is CongregateVille, V-I-L-L-E. Brittany, my understanding is that the big rally that is the anniversary of Charlottesville, that's being held by the hard right, is going to be in front of the White House this weekend. Do I have that right? That they're not planning specific activities for Charlottesville, or are they? Are they coming to your town in a big way?
That is correct. The only permitted rally we know by white nationalists or white supremacists is in Washington, D.C. There are not any permitted events here in Charlottesville. We are, at this point, more concerned with white supremacists trolling our town in small groups, and we are even more concerned with the militarized police state, which puts many of our marginalized community members at risk.
Yeah, remarkable stuff. I wish you the very best. I hope you have a great weekend, and keep up the great work. It's fantastic talking to you and meeting you. Thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you very much.
Reverend Brittany Kane Connolly, and the once again, the website, congregateCville.com. And the Twitter handle is CongregateVille, V-I-L-L-E. We'll be right back with your calls here on Anything Goes Friday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of your calls and the news of the day in just a moment. And welcome back. Andy in Kansas City. Hey, Andy. Andy, thanks for watching on our website. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to compliment you on getting one leg of what happened to the Democratic Party, but I have a theory that might add to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think when Ronald Reagan took the presidency from Jimmy Carter, and he had Vice President Bush, who was an ex-CIA agent, I think
he was the ex-director of the CIA, in fact.
Okay, and I think what happened was that they had a plan to infiltrate the Democratic Party and make it weaker so they could pass their agendas. And the reason that I say that, you and I both remember the term third party member, or the third party,
mm-hmm.
Democrats. Well, I'm thinking that those people that came in as third party Democrats weren't actually dyed-in-the-wool liberal Democrats. They were conservative Democrats, and I mean very conservative. And we're still dealing with that today. There is some legislation that's been passed around in Congress about making it illegal for any American to boycott products or services from Israel. And they want to make that a crime.
Right.
And I would suggest, if you want to see something very interesting, you should look at the Democrats that are supporting that legislation.
Hang on, I'm going to sneeze here. Excuse me. Thank you. I am less inclined to, you know, what you're saying is true, but I'm less inclined to think that it's the consequence of a Republican conspiracy to infiltrate the Democratic Party. As some of this stuff is just insanely seductive. I mean, you know, when what's his name? The guy who worked with Bill Clinton to put together the Democratic Leadership Council, Al Fromm. When Al Fromm and Bill Clinton put this thing together, it was like they were dealing with the crisis of funding that the Democratic Party had in 1990, which was the result of, almost 20 years of Reaganomics and Reagan's war on labor unions. We had gone from about a third of us being, you know, in unions to, I believe around that time, it was as low as, you know, 15%. I mean, it's down to 6% now, but they were running out of money. And so, you know, Al Fromm comes along and says, well, you know, why don't we just start taking money from the banks and from the pharmaceutical companies? These are nice, clean industries. Nobody hates banks or pharmaceutical companies. I mean, we can pick a few corporations to get in bed with. And the Democratic Party went for that. And I mean, you know, hey, money, millions of dollars. That's very, very seductive. And I think your other example, you know, the guys who are saying, oh, let's have a law against the BDS movement, basically, the boycott, divest, and what's the S stand for? So, sanction. That's right. Let's have a law against the BDS movement. There's a lot of money coming out of Israel. There's the AIPAC and maybe not even so much money coming out of Israel. You've got people like Shelley Adelson, who owns I believe it's the largest newspaper in Israel. It's given away for free. It's hard right. It supports Netanyahu. And Shelley Adelson is showering money on Republicans, and he may be giving it to Democrats. And if he's not, there's probably Democratic equivalents. So, you know, do you have any specific evidence of a Republican attempt to infiltrate the Democratic Party, Andy?
I just put that out there as a hypothesis.
Okay, so this is 1 + 1 = 2. You know, I get it. I suspect, though, that the answer is probably much more pedestrian than a fancy conspiracy. Andy, thanks for the call, though, and thanks for listening to us in Kansas City. Welcome back. I want to get back to, just very quickly, and then I'll pick up your phone calls, but this will just take a moment. The Washington Post, on October 13th, Nick Miroff, writing in the Washington Post, and a tip of the hat to the person on Twitter who shared this with me. In fact, let me see if I can just see who it was. No, it's going to take me some time to track it down. Oh, here it is, right here. Good Twitty. Thank you, Good Twitty, for sharing this. Dateline Kansas City, Karnes City, Texas, excuse me. In the past 5 years, Homeland Security officials have jailed record numbers of immigrants driven by a little-known congressional directive known on Capitol Hill as the, quote, bed mandate, end quote. As illegal crossings from Mexico have fallen to near their lowest level since the early 1970s, ICE has been meeting Congress's immigration detention goals by reaching deeper into the criminal justice system to vacuum up foreign-born legal U.S. residents convicted of any crimes that could render them eligible for deportation. The agency has also greatly expanded the number of undocumented immigrants it takes into custody after traffic stops by local police. And then he goes on to say, DHS officials told Congress during the sequestration debate in April, again, this is 2013, that the agency could save money by lowering the bed mandate to 31,800 and relying on cheaper alternatives to jails. But House Republicans successfully pushed back, setting the mandate at 34,000 detainees, it had been 31,000, and ordered ICE officials to spend nearly $400 million more than they requested. Now, the fellow who was on Terry Gross's program yesterday was saying that this is the result of the two companies that have the contract with ICE, Geo Group and whatever the other private prison company is, these two private prison companies, billion-dollar corporations heavily lobbying Congress and basically having this mandate, you must fill these beds. So then we get to this piece in today's Washington Post by Glenn Kessler, the so-called fact checker. Let's fact check Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And he quotes her, ICE is the only criminal investigative agency, the only enforcement agency in the United States that has a bed quota. So ICE is required to fill 34,000 beds with detainees every single night, and that number has only been increasing since 2009, which is what I just read you from the Washington Post from 2013. And it wasn't an op-ed. This is a news story bylined Nick Miroff, a reporter for the Washington Post. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says that, and the Washington Post says, as our friends at PolitiFact documented, this is an urban legend. There is language in the 2016 appropriations bill that requires ICE to have 34,000 beds available. ICE, quote, shall maintain a level of not less than 34,000 detention beds, but it is not required to fill them. The main point of such language, a version of which dated to 2009, is to make sure the money is not spent on something else. Yeah. Aren't we counting angels on the head of a pin here? I mean, this attempt at taking down Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez by today's Washington Post seems to me mean-spirited and pathetic, frankly. Cynthia in Lakewood, Washington. Hey, Cynthia, what's on your mind today? Cynthia, listening on our app in Lakewood, Washington?
Sylvia.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes. No, I was calling because I don't know if people are aware that through the Arbor Day Foundation, you can give like $2 for a tree. They require you to do 10, mm-hmm. but that it they can plant them. And with the forest fires in California, I thought that's a good way to let people know that they can, you know, go to the Arbor Day Foundation and they can do it in memory of people. They can do it in birth of people. They can do it in birthdays. And the other thing I wanted to say is that the money that Trump wants to spend on this military parade, that could be used to help the environment, you know.
Yeah, he's not inclined to do that, but I get your point. Sylvia, the trees from the Arbor Day Foundation, you just give them the money and they plant them someplace. It's not like they're going to send you a tree.
Yeah, they'll send you trees, too, if you want to do that.
Oh, interesting.
But they will plant them in a forest. You know, I've done it for my family, and I just did 500 trees for California. So, yeah, they will, and you can't beat that. $2 a tree to help save the planet.
Yeah,
and
that's fascinating. Sylvia, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, and you have a blessed day.
Thank you. You too, and thanks for sharing that with us. That's fascinating stuff. Doug, or excuse me, Mike in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Basically, I'm your age, and I think every eighth grader should take a civics and American history class and read 1984.
George Orwell's
during
novel.
That time.
Yeah.
Because I think so far I've heard Black Lives Matter is a hate group, and they're attacking Trump, and I heard we're attacking the Christians and everything else.
Yeah, that is newspeak, isn't it? Yeah, that really is newspeak. The problem with asking people to read 1984 is that it was written in the 1950s in the style of the 1930s. You know, Orwell's book is not only dark, but rather difficult to read. I'm waiting. In fact, we tried for some time to contact the estate of Sinclair Lewis because I wanted to take It Can't Happen Here, the story about Buzz Winthrop and, you know, the whole basically the takeover of the United States by a president who campaigned as a populist, you know, with a Bible and a coonskin hat, and then as soon as he became president, started going after the journalists, going after the reporters. In fact, Buzz Winthrop, who fled to Canada in that novel, was a reporter. And it's really, you know, eerily prescient of what's going on right now. trying to contact the estate and say, you know, this story was written in the 1920s and it's almost unreadable because of the use of language, the long paragraphs and awkward sentence construct, what we would today call awkward, and what was, you know, perfectly normal then. And then somebody needs to write a little more dumbed down version. I wouldn't say it that way if I was selling the book, but we were not able to make that. I was gonna rewrite it basically, but I couldn't get a hold of the estate. But I would like to see, you know, yes, I think that, you know, our young people need to be reading these books like It Can't Happen Here in 1984, and Fahrenheit 451. But in addition to that, I would, you know, I'm hopeful that there's a whole new generation of authors who are coming out with those kinds of books right now, because the land is fertile for it. People, I think, would love to read them. Mike, thanks so much for the call. It's great to hear from you. It's coming up on 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, your media support group for We the People. We'll be back with more of your calls. It's Anything Goes Friday. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Here's a headline for you. Fearing blue wave, drug and insurance companies build single-payer defense. Right. Tell you about that in a minute. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a couple of quick things from the interwebs. This on Twitter, somebody tweeted this out. We were talking earlier about, does Fox News have blood on their hands after the whole Laura Ingraham thing, if things go to hell, basically, any place? And this is from Kevin Phillips, who was a political advisor to Richard Nixon. In fact, he was his chief political advisor. He was also the author of The Coming Republican Majority, which was a very, very big, big book in the mid-60s, maybe in the early 70s, but it was really a rather remarkable book. And this is from an interview he gave to the New York Times in 1968. He said, this is from Republicans in their own words, the Southern strategy, right? From now on, the Republicans are never going to get more than 10 to 20% of the Negro vote, and they don't need any more than that. But Republicans would be short-sighted if they weakened enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. The more Negroes who register as Democrats in the South, the sooner the Negrophobe whites will quit the Democrats and become Republicans, because that's where the votes are. Right? I guess, you know, Republicans just kind of say it right out loud every now and then. And Jeff Merkley just sent me and probably a couple hundred thousand other people a note saying, there are many reasons I oppose Donald Trump's latest Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. I want to remind you of three. He rejected an EPA rule that air pollution can be regulated across state lines. I mean, the Constitution just comes right out and says that, you know, one of the things that Congress can do is enact regulations, regulate interstate commerce, actually, is the phrase. So he rejected an EPA rule that air pollution can be regulated across state lines. He struck down part of a ban on hydrofluorocarbons. These are the ozone layer destroying chemicals set in place by the Obama administration. And he has written that the EPA should consider costs to industry prior to regulating air pollution. And he adds, if confirmed, Kavanaugh will put profits over people and pollution over public health. No doubt about it. And I shared with you just before the break, real quickly, fearing a blue wave, drug and insurance companies are building a new organization. It's called the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future. Expect to see ads from them soon. And they are also going to be funding campaigns, particularly Democrats. Industry groups, this Peter Sullivan writing in The Hill today, industry groups are worried that the support for single payer is quickly becoming the default position among Democrats, and they want to push back and strengthen ties to more centrist members of the party. Right. The group's work may include, this is a quote from their press release, may include advertising or the release of studies in the future, but in these early months since we're launched, we focused on continuing to grow our coalition. In other words, shoveling money to Democratic candidates to get them to say, oh, yeah, it's just, you know, it's really cool. The insurance companies and the drug companies, we don't need no stinking single payer. Remarkable. Kirk in Ukiah, California. Hey, Kirk, you wanted to give us an update on the fires in California?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm actually calling within a quarter mile, probably, of the fire line. Mm-hmm. Of the Mendocino complex, now the largest complex of fires in the history of the state of California. Mm-hmm. things are looking a little better, but we still have two more days of red flag conditions that we have to make it through in order to really turn the corner on this. But what I wanted to mention was that recently I ran into a couple of Republican acquaintances who have adopted, I'll say, I call them Trumpets, post-election Trump supporters. Recently ran into a couple of them, and they were concerned about the fires and talked about how terrible arsonists are, and I have to agree with them. But when I mentioned to them that Trump had recently pardoned two convicted arsonists in Oregon, which was the start of that takeover by the Clive and Bundy gang.
Or the Balfour National Park thing, as I recall.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Malmer.
It started with an M. Yeah.
So these two characters, well, they're ranchers, and they started some fires on that area. And the Clive and Bundy gang came up and took it over to protest. Well, Trump recently pardoned those two ranchers who were convicted and in prison for arson. And when I mentioned that to a couple of Republican acquaintances that support Trump, it looked like a light bulb may have come on in their head.
Interesting. Wasn't that a bit of a technicality, though, Kirk? Wasn't it that they were occupying the national park area, and you know, as a pseudo political statement, and that they built a fire to dispose of trash or to cook food or something like that, and it got a little out of control. I mean, it didn't cause a forest fire, but that was the arson charge. Or do I have that wrong?
No, the way I understand it, these two ranchers were doing some control burns to improve the grazing for their cattle.
Ah, okay.
Were arrested for that.
I see.
This is well before the takeover.
Right.
So this is a righteous arson case that Trump has essentially ignored.
Wow. Amazing.
And so people should pass that on. You know, these fires go through people's heads pretty fast. When it's over and it's raining, we'll forget about it. So right now, pass it on to folks that Trump has pardoned arsonists. And I don't know what a strategy there is, but I don't approve of it.
Well, his strategy was they're with Clive and Bundy. I'm with Clive and Bundy, you know, so therefore, it was a shout out to what's that sheriff's organization now where they're saying, you know, only sheriffs can enforce the constitutional law, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we've had, the Oath Keepers. We've had Richard Mack on this program a couple of times talking about it. Kirk, thanks for the call. And thanks for the heads up. Fascinating stuff. Amazing. Doug in Muncie, Indiana. Hey, Doug, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you. You were wondering earlier about whether there had been an increase in hate crimes since Trump took office.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because you're not going to see an increase in hate crimes in Indiana. The reason is because there is no such thing as a hate crime.
Oh, so if the state doesn't measure it, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but the thing is, you're never going to see a increase of something over nothing.
Right.
And there are a handful of other states that don't have hate crimes either. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
And, of course, even if you do have hate crimes in your state, it's going to be up to the discretion of the prosecutors or the police what does designate a hate crime.
Yeah, and, this is true.
And so, but I just thought you'd find it interesting that there are states that don't have any such thing as a hate crime.
Yeah.
Now, here in Indiana, that's come to light recently because there was a vandalism of a synagogue or a temple, Nazi flags, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought out the ire of our Republican governor, Eric Holcomb. And he's pushing to get hate crimes established in the state right now.
Mm-hmm.
And what's curious to me is what would be the objection to having such a crime on the books? And
it doesn't play well with the Southern strategy of the Republican Party. That's the objection.
So people might want to analyze why they would be against such a thing.
Yeah. Excellent point, Doug. Excellent point. Thank you for the call. Well said. It's amazing what's going on. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Dr. Tom. Thanks for picking me up.
Sure.
In regard to your comment about the health insurance industry looking for Democratic people to lobby them and give them money, that is one of the things that we're watching. And people are about fed up with whether or not our Congress is more interested in getting money from these corporations than they are in than our representatives and our senators working for us.
Right.
And this is why they are so afraid of the blue wave. But most people have now come to the conclusion that our Congress is a corrupt, isolated unit that does not work for the people. It works for the corporations.
And it's not just federally. This is true of most of the state houses around the country, too.
Yes, and we have that problem here. You know, our Secretary of State is running a cross-check against driver's license and voting registrations.
Yeah.
And anybody that wants to vote, they'd better get a certified birth certificate and a valid voter ID and verify their registration from now until the day we vote. But these corporations that think that they can continue to control the country, they're waking up to the fact that we know what they're doing now.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're going after individual members of Congress. And if those congressmen turn out to be corrupt enough to take the money from these lobbyists, they're going to be voted out, because we are, you know, we're organized now and we know what they're doing. And if they're not just a sexual predator, they are money addicts. And we don't want either one in Congress anymore. We want people who will actually run the country properly. And we're fed up with the corporations ordering our military to invade a country so they can rape that country's resources.
Yep.
All of this stuff has got to stop, or they're going to be out of office pretty quick.
From your lips to God's ears, Norma. I'm with you. Thank you very much for the call. And it's a sentiment I think we all share. You know, the Republican Party entirely in the bag with the corporations. The Democratic Party dealing with this challenge to its existence. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Larry in Santa Monica, California. Hey, Larry, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV.
Hey.
What's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm well. What's up?
Good. Hey, I've been listening to you for, I guess, probably now about 9 years.
Oh, my.
When you were first in Oregon. And I know you're not with all the accolades, but I can tell you what, I've never heard a white man or person speak so intelligently, coherently, and succinctly about the issues of people of color as you. And so I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Larry. I'm still learning.
Yeah, we all are, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and I just wanted to say, you know, I grew up in a predominantly, all white neighborhood back in the late 70s. My family was the first black family on our street. My sister and I were the first two black kids at our school.
Wow.
So I have a little bit of an insight into the psyche of white people who are unexposed. Unlike evangelical Christians, I think all people are basically good. But I think a lot of white Americans, and probably the majority of white Americans, are unexposed. They're not racist people. They're unexposed. They're prejudiced. They're bigoted. But I don't think they're racist. I think that word is thrown around very cavalierly. I think to be a racist, you have to have your hands on the levers of power. I think Mitch McConnell is a racist. I think Paul Ryan is a racist. I think Donald Trump is the racist in chief, because they can enact policies that directly impact people of color. But your average American white American who lives in unexposed neighborhoods, they just don't know. They haven't encountered us. I remember when I was a child, you know, and thinking back on it, you know, white kids would literally touch my hair and
mm-hmm.
say, "Oh, that feels so different. That's so, you know," because they didn't know us. They had no experience with us. But, you know,
and it goes a step beyond that, if I may, real quick, Larry. And that is that for anybody who's over 40 or 50, basically who grew up in a white community, basically their most of their exposure to in particular black people, but this is also true of Hispanics and Asians, was based on caricature. Was based on these bizarre roles that were the acceptable roles for black people on television and movies that don't reflect the reality of the humanity of an entire race of people.
Oh, totally. And I'm a watcher of TCM, Turner Classic Movie Channel, and you watch some of these old movies and the caricatures of black people that they, you know, you're the maid, you're a buffoon, you're stupid, you're bumbling, you know. So no, you're completely correct. And how else would they know?
Yep.
How else would they know how a typical black person was if they weren't exposed personally, except through the television?
Yep. So Larry, we've got 20 seconds until we're hitting a break. You got a point you want to make here, or did you want to just share?
Yeah. So my point is that I don't think most white people who harbor racial angst against any person of color, whether it be black, Latino, Asian, or whatever, I don't think that they're necessarily racist. To be a racist, I believe you have to have your hands on the levers of power. I think these people are ignorant and unexposed, and I think that if they would just simply open their minds and get to know someone of color, that could be actually extinguished.
I agree, largely. The problem is when they're facilitating racists like Donald Trump. But I get your point, Larry. Very, very spot on. Thank you. Taking back the mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Gene, listening on WFTE in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Gene, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. Great show today.
Thank you.
I'm an avid listener and a learner for many years, and I keep learning, and I love your listeners also. I'm calling because I changed my mind about Antifa and this rally that's coming up. While I support the good people of Antifa who want to stand there against Nazism and white supremacy, I also don't want them to get hurt. And I really see this, you know, you're going to be fighting the Prayer Boys, United Front, whatever they want to call themselves, Nazis, on their terms. And these guys lust for violence. They lust for it. And I don't see Antifa winning in any way.
Yeah, I've talked about this a number of times, the conundrum that the mostly peaceful tribes of the East Coast had when the first contact with Europeans back in the early 1600s. They were facing a technologically superior force. That is the piece of it that's typically focused on in history books. But the reality is that there was a cultural superiority is totally the wrong word, but a major cultural difference in that the Europeans were coming out of thousands of years of genocidal warfare, kill everybody warfare, wipe out the entire tribe warfare in Europe. And they brought that ethos with them to North America, and it was completely alien by and large to those tribes along the East Coast. And so they were confronted with fight them back, and they didn't have the technology to do that. So when they tried to fight them, they died. Or run from them, which many of them did. But, you know, there's a limit to how far you can go. You eventually hit the Pacific Ocean. But the hardest part was if you fought them, you became them. And particularly if you fought them in a genocidal fashion, the net result was that the Indians got basically wiped out. And I think that Antifa is probably... I don't know what the debates are going on inside the movement, but it seems like it would be a good thing if they were a variation on this conversation. You know, what do we do? How do we stop? How do we fight something without becoming it?
That's the question, and I think the streets should be empty when these people come. It would really help if the media didn't promote it.
Yes.
That would help a lot.
Yes.
But also the fact that... I just lost my train of thought, but I come from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Trump just had a rally not that long ago. Mm-hmm. It was basically promoted on the local stations. The media seems to be, even if they're reporting negative stuff, and they seem to want the negative stuff, of course, you know, that's going to give them ratings.
Yep.
I think I don't think the way to fight these guys is to fight them at their rallies. I think people are going to get hurt, and it really, really scares me.
Yeah, yeah. Tom Friedman published a piece in yesterday's New York Times suggesting that there should be more coverage, not less, of Donald Trump, because the more good people see of how horrible Trump is, the more inclined they are to go away from him. I'm very ambivalent about that.
He's got so much coverage. The media built him up. The media can take him down.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
we never heard a Bernie Sanders speech in its entirety, but we would hear about Donald Trump in ad nauseum.
Oh, yeah. We'll hear an entire hour of his rallies on all three cable networks. Yeah. Gene, excellent points all. Thank you very much for calling and making them. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Yeah, you know, your point about not covering it, or how do you fight against something without becoming part of it?
Yeah.
I would refer to the Gospels, where Jesus said, "Do not fight against evil, turn away from it."
Amen.
And the point being that if you fight against it, you get it on you. It's kind of like a tar baby, you know, you get it all over you. So the best thing is to turn away from it. But I wanted to point this out, and I'm referring to Amy Goodman, and Democracy Now! Reported this week that one of the lead organizers of this white supremacist rally and one of the lead troublemakers and organizers of the Charlottesville fiasco is a guy who is a member of the United States military, and he's stationed at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. He's a water purification specialist, apparently. His name, you're going to have to help me, is his name or his, I guess his organization, that he is Atomwaffen, A-T-O-M, is this, help me with the German, Tom.
Yeah, Waffen, you know, yeah. Well, W's are pronounced like a V in German, but so I believe it would be Waffen, or maybe they've anglicized it. I don't know, Paul. But that,
but
you know, the
anti-American Waffen group.
The Waffen SS.
White supremacists, they're anti-America.
Yeah, well, they're fascists.
A member of the United States military. I don't know. I suppose, you know, when you talk about Trump and his football players shouldn't take a knee, can the United States military censor his free speech? I don't think so, but...
Yes, they can.
This is what we got. This is what we have going
on here. When you join the military, you sign a contract that suspends all of your constitutional rights, including, you know, basically everything. You are no longer subject to the American Code of Criminal Justice. You are subject to the military code, the Code of Military Justice.
According to Amy Goodman, he has posted on a Facebook page a video of him jumping in and assaulting a woman, delivering a kick to one of the anti-racist protesters in Charlottesville, and is taking. I guess the video is not clear as to whether he actually did kick her, but he's claiming that he did. He's saying, "Yeah, look what I did." So he committed assault, a felonious assault. He's bragging about it. He's part of the military. This is really disturbing, especially when you think about it. You know, every department of government has a less than 50% approval rating, except the military has about a 70% approval rating. This is what I think military coups are made out of.
Yeah.
You know, this is getting really, and I think you're right about it can't happen here. It is happening here. It's happening here right now, right before our eyes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It really is, and it's really frightening that America could be derailed. Well, so was Germany, derailed by such a minority of people.
Yeah.
Because this is not what America stands for or thinks or believes or feels. What's going on now with the Trump? And the other thing is, I wanted to point out is that how much they've drifted from what was supposedly the optimism of Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. Paul, I got to run. We're hitting the break here. Thanks a lot, though. Your points are always well made. What a week. We'll be back on Monday, no doubt. You know, Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. And in the meantime, you know, I hope you have a wonderful and safe weekend. But don't forget, there's a lot of work that we've got to do. So we can't, you know, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.